Welcome back to the Vital Masculinity Podcast. This week, we continue our discussion on gender roles. Last week, we talked about what gender roles are and what it looks like to be a son and a brother. So if you haven't listened to that, stop right now and go check that out because this episode builds on that one. And once you've done that, come back and listen to this because this will be important and helpful for you as well. This week, we are talking about what it means to be a husband and a father. And so, whether you're looking to be a father or a husband, or whether you are, or whether you're not, I think you'll still find that this is applicable to you, and we can all learn something about what it means to be a father, what it means to be a husband. Because in many ways, we take on these roles in a variety of circumstances, whether or not we are a biological father or married. And as a single man myself, I know that I benefited a lot from this episode, and I'm sure Stephen, as a married man, also benefited from it. So even if you don't think this applies to you, stay tuned because I think you might be surprised. And with that, let's get on with the show. When I think about being a husband or a wife, I mean, I'm not a husband or a wife, but I feel like you have, I don't know, just from my perspective, you have the dating process, and that's kind of like, you're almost taking on like a brotherly or sisterly role as you're dating, as you're courting. Obviously, it's romantic, so it's the analogy doesn't work great, but you're building a friendship. And as that friendship builds, as you recognize, you know, some qualities that you're looking for in that, then you get married, hopefully, or you break up. But in this case, you get married and you become a husband or a wife. So what, what does that look like as we transform from just dating, you know, being friends to being a husband and a wife? How does that... Does that tie into dating?
I think so. When you get married, it is kind of the solidification of the relationship, that eros, that erotic relationship that is a very important part of I think, human life for 99.9% of us. And dating, obviously, if done correctly, if done well, and I'll link to some of the episodes where we talk about dating well and dating virtuously, but if it's done correctly, it is kind of done with this end goal in mind. The fact that, you know, at the end of the day, the boyfriend will mature into the husband, the girlfriend will mature into the wife. And that maturation is actually something that's very important because it's not something that happens automatically. You know, you can't just get married and automatically become a leader or provider or protector or what have you. You need to make sure if you are dating right now, if you're not married, that you develop these things going into and directed towards marriage. And then even after you're married, it's something that's important to cultivate as well. Now, one of the first, I think this is actually a really important role, and we'll probably talk about this a little more than some of the previous roles, because this role and the role of father or mother coming up after this really draw on a lot of the biological, neurological, physiological, psychological realities that we discussed in the past few episodes, because this is really the first role where it's a man and a woman kind of in their fullness, interacting with, complementing each other. And one of the first ones is, you know, the husband is the leader of the household. And this is something that's been seen across cultures. It's not just a patriarchal, you know, invention or what have you. It's something that has basically always been the case. A great, you know, example in a religious context, but I think still fits the bill, is St. John Chrysostom called the husband the general, where the wife is kind of the lieutenant general. So they both have that level of authority, but the imagery is still, you know, one, not necessarily of total subservience, but one of, they both have kind of complementary roles because the general and the lieutenant general do different things. And this is definitely something that's very important, and we can see it coming out of a lot of the, like, the ways that, as we discussed in the communication episode, men and women kind of communicate and lead, where women are going to be a lot more relational, where men are a lot more kind of goal-oriented or object-oriented, And having that is actually, that object-orientedness is actually a very important point if you are going to be a leader, because it can kind of make sure you stay on track. And good families, the ones that have kind of survived over the centuries and passed on their genes, are the ones that were, you know, not necessarily getting pulled to and fro, but the ones that were a lot more rooted, that had, kind of goals. They were you know, aiming towards living a certain style of life. They were aiming towards a certain, style of family, and that, and so on and so on. So that's something that's kind of important to keep in mind when we are talking about the leader of the household, that it is not something that is a construct, but it's something that is developed in communication patterns and the psychology of men and women.
Some of the listeners may have been listening to this and be like, whoa, 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 whoa. This is like way too old fashioned. I just checked out, didn't hear anything you said after the man's supposed to be the leader. And maybe men, not so much, but if we have female listeners, maybe. Although, honestly, I know female listeners would be like, yes, yes. But yeah, I think it's just, I don't know. It's part of our culture, the way that we've grown up, at least me, to be like, man, the man's the leader. I don't know about that. I don't know, this just image of, Clint Eastwood or John Wayne or someone like that, you know, the strong, silent type who, you know, doesn't take anything from his woman, doesn't, you know, tells her what to do. He goes and spanks her if she doesn't listen to him. You know, like just thinking like the rule of thumb, which apparently is the size of the stick you could use to beat your wife. I don't know, just all these images come to mind, probably from like feminist propaganda or something. But what would you say to someone that's like, oh, you're just perpetuating this oppressive thing? Why can't men and women just be, you know, equal leaders? They'll just share the leadership. So what's your argument for that? Why not just, you know, that no one's the leader, they just both take turns or something like that?
So I'll give two reasons for that. And the first would be, you know, if you've listened to our previous episodes where we're talking about psychological, physiological differences, communication differences between men and women, my first question would be, do you agree with that? And, you know, I think it's very hard to disagree with that, both considering the sources that we've provided, as well as just, as we've mentioned so many times, just kind of how you look at people, your inductive reasoning, the fact that it's very easy to tell a man or a woman. You don't need to go up, you know, to the cashier and, you know, at a Harris Teeter or wherever and be like, are you a man or a woman? It's pretty easy to tell, even beyond physical characteristics. So if you agree with that, then the next question that I'll ask is, you know, let's say you're at a job, and let's say that there are two people that are sharing the same role, and it, you know, it doesn't need to necessarily be a big job, but if there's two people that are fighting basically over the same role, do you think that'll be efficient? Do you think that'll be productive? Do you think that there will be harmony or animosity between those two people? Well, as someone coming from experience, two people that are trying to basically share the same role or trying to, you know, fit into one pair of shoes, It is not necessarily a seamless transition. And while you can say that, you know, the husband and wife relationship is or should be based on love, you know, a lot of people that say that are kind of basing it on a feeling as compared to kind of the underlying, you know I love my wife versus I feel I love my wife. And so if you agree that there are differences between men and women, and you agree that it is not exactly the healthiest or the most conducive to a good relationship for two people to be fighting over the same role, then very easily the answer should be then that there are previously defined roles that suit, you know, each one's strengths and help compensate and complement each other's weaknesses. And that's, I think, exactly what we see here. You know, the general versus lieutenant general is just one example, one image, but there's plenty of other examples. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we're not saying that, and this is, I think, the image a lot of like feminists have in their mind, where it's like the women are basically at the level of children and men kind of command them around, almost in a Von Trapp family where the man blows a whistle and not only do the children come, but the wife comes running as well. Or, you know, things like that. That level of imagery, you know, while it may have been true in some cases, you know, kind of the 1950s stuff, isn't always the truth. And that's not to say that, you know, it's bad or it's good, But also, we're not saying we go back to the 1950s or things like that. You know, we need to look well beyond the past couple of decades and look how men and women have related to each other in these two roles throughout all of history. And I think, again, the general versus lieutenant general, one has clear authority over the other, but that doesn't mean that the lieutenant general doesn't have authority. It's just that her authorities are of a different sort. And this kind of gets back to the whole complementary nature that we've talked about a lot with Scott and with Todd in our interviews with them, where men and women should complement one another, but if they're trying to substitute one another, that's where competition and disharmony enter into the relationship.
Yeah, maybe I'm not such a great devil's advocate because I agree with you, but I think there are people out there that have this idea. And I guess one thing that I would expand upon is that I think part of our hesitancy is that we live in a society that is very egalitarian, democratic. You know, we tend to think of like, well, it's better to have a bunch of people, working together and cooperating, which, yeah, it is. I mean, it's good to have cooperation with between husband and wife, too. But, there's a point to having a CEO, a president, a leader, whoever it might be. Like, not only, it's not just about telling people what to do. Just look at the news. Like, everyone's complaining about what Trump does. And, you know, certainly he makes decisions, but, like, people are trying to hold him accountable. And that's what I think that's what a good wife should do. She should hold her husband accountable. And also, like, if you're the leader, you're the person that's responsible. And that's a key here to recognize is, you know, maybe you make the choice ultimately. Although I think ideally the husband and wife would discuss this and decide, but you know, the husband, if there's a disagreement, then the husband someone has to be the tiebreaker. And you know, that person, you know, they're taking responsibility. They, if something goes wrong, they're the person that's ultimately responsible. And so it's not just, you know, saying I get to decide what to do, but I'm the person that's going to take the blame. I'm going to take the fall for this. It's kind of like the idea of a good general is, you know, they would be the first one into battle. Like, not this modern idea of where the general sits back and organizes things, although there's certain points to that. Obviously, he has other men going to the battle. But you think of, like, the romantic idea of the general. He's leading the charge. And I think that's really what the leader should be like. And that kind of ties into what we're going to talk about in a second here about being a protector. It's the person who's willing to lead the charge, willing to, you know, give his life for the cause. That's what a leader is being about, not just telling people what to do.
And I think we can just jump down to protector and then circle back up to provider. But you really do have kind of the sub roles for men and women, where men are typically the protectors of the family, where women are the nurturers. And there's a lot that goes into this, but I think the imagery is still pretty simple, where women were kind of going back to that greenhouse analogy, where they could be at home, they could kind of be isolated and still have a mature femininity and mature in their femininity. Women are the ones that are typically staying home and are rearing the children and all that comes with that, both physically as well as, you know, with the education, you know, providing them sustenance and things like that. While men are the people that are basically the first line of defense. They are the people that help create the safe place, where the women are the ones that nurture the safe place. So that, you know, the women are inside the greenhouse, the men are outside patrolling that greenhouse. And there was a couple of reasons that it was traditionally the man. Again, it wasn't because men got together and there was a great conspiracy to keep women out. But as we've mentioned before, you know, men are typically, in 99% of the cases, bigger, faster, and stronger. They had the potential for military service more than women. Actually, most women, I can't think of any ancient or classical or medieval examples, maybe outside of Joan of Arc, and that was a very special case where there was a woman in a military service. But on top of that, you know, men had the capacity, not capacity, but men had the means more often than women to have more specialized combat training and things like that. And realistically, a man's body is just kind of designed to protect, you know, with our broad shoulders and chest and such, versus the women who's much more designed to nurture with all that comes with that.
Just going back to this book that I'm reading, because I think it kind of ties into what you're saying about Joan of Arc, because actually he refers to Joan of Arc as well in this book, and basically talking about, you know, this is a extraordinary circumstance. Like, I'm not an expert on the story of Joan of Arc, but from what I understand, basically the men, they rejected their responsibility. They were not the protectors in this situation. And Joan of Arc had to take this extraordinary role, to take this leadership role, because a man was unwilling to do so, to do the right thing. And that's kind of a, if we go back to this idea of the man being the first line of defense, the man has to be the first line of defense. If he's not the first line of defense, the woman has does not have this safe place to be a nurturing mother, to be a nurturer. You think of like the example of the mama bear who gets upset. Like, you know, she'd probably prefer being with her cubs and nurturing her cubs. But if some man or some outside force comes in, mama bear is going to get upset and she's going to do something about it. But like, that's not her primary role. That's not the role that she's, that her children are going to flourish in. Just think about, you know, the cubs are playing, they're eating, doing whatever they're doing, and then some hunter comes along. Like, that's not good for the cubs, that's not good for the mama bear, but she's gonna have to do something about it. But if the papa bear was out there and he was, you know, taking on the hunter or something like that, I don't know, this is a crazy analogy, but you know, he's, the mama bear can still be with the cubs and nurturing them, and they don't even know what's going on. So it's very important, and I think the reason that so many women are, you know, turning to feminism, turning to this, rejecting these roles, is because so many men have abandoned their responsibility to provide a safe place. Because I think when women have a safe place, when they have an opportunity to nurture, they prefer to do that. But in so many situations, they either have an abusive husband or a husband that, you know, just sits on the couch and watches TV and doesn't protect them. Or, I mean, in many ways, if you think about it, watching the TV, having the news on, like, that's just bringing the outside world into your home. And it might be causing stress to the wife just by seeing all the crazy things that are going on. So it's, I don't know, I'm just thinking from example.
My mother, I love that analogy.
Yeah. 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 My mother, like, I think this is why this is so important, because I think of examples like my mother, like my girlfriend, my female friends. You know, they come home from work and they talk about, you know, oh, work was stressful, this and that. You know, maybe, you know, someone wasn't trying to kill them, but it's still stressful. Like, things happen. And you know, just comparing that to a man, comparing to that myself, you know, like my girlfriend asks me, oh, how was work? Or my mom asks me, how was work? And I'm like, I don't know, that was like an hour ago, I forgot what happened. But they can't let it go. And so I think that's kind of why it's important to man, for a man to be the protector here, because they can't let it go, it causes a stress and a drain on them that they aren't as equipped to handle as a man is.
Absolutely. And excuse me. And another, you know, kind of subset role of the father and the mother, the husband and wife, is the provider and the receiver. And this in many ways kind of relates to the conversation we've just been having. But if you look throughout history, you know, men without a doubt were the ones that were typically out working. And there's a lot of reasons for this. You know, a lot of the labor was more manual. So men who were kind of much more expendable in the sense that women were a little more valuable because of their, you know, ability to get pregnant. They, you know, men didn't need any downtime for pregnancy. Men were stronger, as we mentioned. But also, I think you could argue that men are more goal-oriented, which in some instances makes them more efficient than women who are much more relationship-oriented. So these men were traditionally the people that would go out and, you know, work. They would kind of act as a conduit between the economy of the state or the outside world and the home. And this actually ties in very well with the protector, where, you know, it was their responsibility, if they were being a good man, to not bring back business, or at the very least negative business, from the outside world into their home, which is another reason I think that TV example you have is actually a really, really great great image and analogy for both of these roles, actually. And then, so that's the man, the provider. And on the flip side, you have the receiver. And I don't know if I necessarily like this word that much, but I think it's still pretty apt because, you know, if you think about the classic adage, bringing home the bacon, well, it would be the man's responsibility to bring home the bacon, but then it would be the woman's responsibility to, you know, cook it, to provide it to the family and the children, and use that to nurture it. So this is actually, you know, a great example where we can take a step back, particularly if you are kind of, you know, initially repulsed by these images or saying that, you know, men can do this or women can do the same work as men. This is where you have to kind of take a step back and look at the complementary nature that we've stressed so often. Yes, both a man and a woman can provide, and yes, a man and a woman can both receive in many instances. But at the end of the day, you know, women are much more apt to being those people that are going to receive and transform the home versus the man, who is much more goal-oriented. They're much more designed in their body and their mind to go out and to be the people that are going to both protect, like we mentioned, but also, you know, do the work that they can provide for their wives and for their family. So keeping that in mind is something that's very important, because the second you start to begin to blur the lines between provider and receiver, this is, I think, where it truly becomes easy for people to kind of believe in that everyone's like a cog in the machine, everyone's irreplaceable, or everyone is replaceable, I should say, and men and women are substitutes. And as we've mentioned before in previous episodes, that's a very, very dangerous image to hold in your mind, because it really does inform all of your other relationships and how you view men and women in general.
As you were going over this, I was thinking of a quote from Chesterton, and I'm not going to quote him directly, but he makes a point in one of his articles. I think it's from the book What Is Wrong with the World. He talks about how people, feminists, you know, I guess most people in our culture today have this idea that, you know, being a housewife is a bad thing. It's a oppressive thing. But he talks about how, you know, a housewife, she's nurturing. She's not just a specialist in one job. She has many jobs. And in that sense, she has a great responsibility and something that should be appreciated and recognized for all the work that she's doing. And without the, I guess, and he expands upon this to talk about, you know, when women go into the workforce, they almost tend to treat their job like they are the wife to the job. And I don't know if I agree with this exactly, but I think there's a point to be made. And I look at the women that I work with in my job. For example, my boss, she's a woman, and she's joked many times, and I think she's just joking, but I think there is really some truth to it, where she kind of acts like the office mom. Like, she almost treats her role like a motherly role. And I've seen, you know, younger women and probably the older women who are working as well, they kind of treat their job as almost like a wife. I think about, you know, some women I work with, they want to make the place a nurturing home. Like, it's almost like a homey feel. Like, especially like HR people, like they're always looking on how to make it a nurturing place. And even the people that aren't working in HR, I don't know. Do you kind of see this example in your work environments? Like, they're almost playing like either like a motherly or a wifely role in the workplace. And I think to this point, I think that's why people like Mike Pence, they make this rule, like they don't go on work dates with people that aren't their wives. And I think that can actually be very dangerous, because even though where it's like, okay, well, we're just co-workers, I don't think that the dynamic is the same between two male co-workers and a male and female co-worker.
Absolutely. And you know, we'll certainly talk about that whole male and female dynamic, particularly when we get into our series on the virtue love and kind of friendship in general. But I certainly see that. I think, you know, even at a base level, when you look at who is inheriting these roles, who, who is administrating them, women are much more oriented to, you know, home or human resources and those sorts of roles in this economy. I mean, heck, they're even a lot more, oriented towards accounting, and I can speak firsthand as an accountant. And that's always confused me, but I think a lot of it is because, you know, while men would bring home the bacon, women in many respects over the past couple of decades and centuries would be the kind of the prudent household administrator or the steward of the money, because they would spend the money that the father would bring home to, you know, work on the upkeep of the little house of that domicile. So I think it's certainly visible both in, you know, the roles that women are holding, and it's not because there's a conspiracy again. It's not because they were shoehorned in there and they really wanted to be engineers and you know, computer scientists. It's just because that their, you know, their predispositions, their communication styles, psychological differences, and all these things make them much more suited to that kind of motherly or, you know, wifely role of administrating, you know, a company which in many ways resembles a very large family.
I think probably the analogy goes both ways. I'm sure that men take on like a fatherly role. I can definitely think of managers that I've had. They kind of had at least certainly earlier in my career, they kind of took on a fatherly role. And there's kind of this brotherly role between male coworkers, and probably a sisterly role between female coworkers, although I don't experience that. I think that's why it's important to recognize these roles and to realize that they kind of go outside the house. They go with you everywhere. Like it's not just a role that you fit into, the hat you put on. It's something that goes with you everywhere. And especially for the woman who is very relationally minded, she takes this everywhere. And so when she's acting as a company wife or a company mother, she's going to take that home with her. And whereas a man, he can kind of just set that aside and at least a lot more easily than a woman would.
Absolutely. And one last thing on this point is kind of related to politics, and we're not going to get into this too much, but it's very clear that when a man isn't really fulfilling his role as protector, provider, or just, you know, as the man of the household, women typically tend to look to the government for, you know, protection, for leadership, and for to provide for them. And I think kind of at face value, I don't want to spend too much time on this because it's just my opinion, but I think when you kind of look at the, you know, who votes for, I'll say big government or, you know, the typically more liberal or progressive side versus who votes for a smaller government, when you're looking at women, it's a lot of the women that vote for big government or vote liberal are typically going to be single women or younger women that don't have really strong or rooted relationships, versus a lot of the people who are voting, a lot of the women that are voting for the conservatives or the, you know, the smaller government parties, that they have a, you know, a stronger rooted relationship. They may be a little bit older and have developed those roots with their husband or in, you know, with their husband in a community, to kind of further that, you know, or to lessen, I should say, that need for the government to come in and really provide.
Going back to the point we made about the man's body is designed in certain ways and women's body is designed in certain ways, I think about, if we think just specifically about the biology, the, you know, the sexual reproductive organs, a man's organs are very outward. They are, you know, they're giving something, whereas a female is receiving. She has to open up, not to get too graphic, but she has to open up and receive. And that definitely ties into being a father and a mother, but also kind of ties into being a husband and wife. Like just looking at the outward nature of the man and the inward nature, the nurturing nature of the woman. So we think about, you know, sexual reproduction, a man is providing his quote unquote seed and a man is receiving it and nurturing it within the womb. And as she's doing that, you know, she is carrying around this baby and she has to take care of it. So the man is protecting her and keeping her safe.
Right. And that's something, you know, like we've mentioned before and throughout this episode, you need to kind of look at all these roles with the mindset that they are informed by the biological, the psychological, and yada, 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 versus just kind of coming out of nowhere. Because there is a reason that the very large majority of women and men are, you know, either trying to fulfill these roles, or at the very least, they have tendencies toward them. And to divert from these roles is actually a distortion of masculinity or femininity.
What else can we say about being a father or a mother? Because that's kind of what we've touched on a little bit here.
Right.
I'm not a father, or you're not a father, so I guess.
Yeah.
What would we say just from observation, from ancient wisdom about fatherhood and motherhood?
Well, not even ancient wisdom. I think even drawing on the interviews I mentioned before with Scott and Todd, both of which are fathers to multiple children, you see really two other roles kind of arise. And outside of just procreation, you see the role of a teacher. And this is actually an interesting one because I think, you know, just by induction again, you'll realize if you're kind of astute that most teachers are women. Teachers and educators tend towards being womanly, and even at home, like my wife wants to homeschool, it's going to be her that's going to be doing the bulk of that. I mean, maybe I'll do Latin or calculus or things like that because I'm more suited to those. But while men may not be necessarily responsible for direct education, they're still, first of all, held accountable for it, which means that the men will still be judged by the education or the lack of education and upbringing of the children. It's not something that they can kind of get off scot-free for. But another thing that's actually very important, particularly when it comes to the raising of boys, is that both by their example and by their words and deeds, they will be teaching their sons how to be good sons and by kind of extension, good husbands and good fathers. So this is, I think, actually very poignant when you're looking at the crisis of fatherlessness or single motherhood, like we mentioned before, where not having those good masculine influences, which I think is a lot of people are beginning to realize now, that's actually causing and perpetuating this cycle to continue where, you know, a son doesn't have a good husband or father, or I'm sorry, a son doesn't have a good father, and then he grows up to not be necessarily the best husband or the best father or the best brother to either his siblings or to his friends. So having this leadership by example, which can really kind of just be described like a teacher role as well, is really vital to the perpetuation of good and virtuous masculinity throughout the generations.
Just to put a religious spin on this, when we, as a Catholic, we look at marriage specifically as, you know, has a couple different ends to it, you know, the purpose of it. And two of those are obviously, the one we think of most regularly is the relationship between the man and the wife, is between, you know, their relationship, building a friendship, building a relationship, and growing with one another. But also, the responsibility and the reason you get married is because you plan to have children. You plan to procreate and raise children and educate those children. And I think that that's something that is kind of lost, at least the education part these days, and in many cases the procreation part, but that's another story. You think of education, well, we're just going to send them off to school. We'll send them off to, you know, public school, whatever school, I don't know, private school, doesn't really matter. You're sending them off, you know, the experts, that's their responsibility. It's the experts' responsibility to teach my kids. And I think, you know, homeschooling definitely addresses the responsibility as being a parent of teaching. And I think that that definitely helps to bring it to the forefront. But which seems to be something that's lost when you send your kids off to have someone else teach them, which I think is a real shame if that's the mindset. And I think that's kind of the mindset that it instills in people. It doesn't have to. I think that people can do a good job with sending their kids if they need to send them to public school. God forbid, or a private school. But it's definitely something that we have to consciously recognize that, you know, I'm not just creating these kids, but I'm actually teaching them how to be virtuous men and women, how to grow. And like you said, setting example, how to be a good son, you know, as the, showing them how you interact with their grandparents, or helping them to be good to you as a husband and father, and showing that example of what it looks like to be a husband and a father to them.
So I think there's actually one other role. Well, I said there was one other role, and I don't know how much we want to get into this role right now, but we can at least introduce it. Another role of being a good father is what I'll call the priest. And there's a lot of background for this, and I think it can still kind of fit into our next episode, which is going to be kind of roles outside the house. But the priest, kind of at face value, is the one that holds the sacrificial role. He is the one both that sacrifices himself and sacrifices other things for his family. He's the father, quote unquote, of the people outside of the family, but he's also the father in actuality inside the family. And you can also kind of see this in the sense that he acts as a mediator on behalf of others. So he's acting, as a mediator between the outside world and the family, and all of his actions, if he's doing them in a good way and in a virtuous way, are on behalf of his family. That is always what his kind of arbiter of goodness in a very temporal sense is located. So I think that's why it's important to discuss the priesthood aspect of being a father, and that really sacrificial nature. Now, Brian, if you want to get into this right now, I'm more than okay with it. But if not, we can also save this. All right, then I'll pass the buck to you.
Yeah. So I think the priest is, you know, people hear that, and especially if you're not religious, you'd be like, what does this have to do with everything? But I honestly feel like this has everything to do with what it means to be a man. And kind of ties into everything that we just talked about. So let's think about a priest. A priest is a father. How is a priest a father? Well, in this case, obviously, if you're a biological father, and you're taking on this role, then that makes sense. But if we think about, I don't know, Catholic priests usually aren't fathers, I guess Orthodox priests usually are. So maybe that's a little bit different, but either way, if we think of the religious role of a priest, bringing children into the church, like baptizing them, they're welcoming them into the life of Christ, of the life of God. So that's kind of how they're giving them, so the father gives a child life through the mother, and the priest gives the child the life of God through the mother, which is the church. I guess just tying this together, like we think about a priest, they preach, they teach, they protect their flock. They're a good shepherd. They are a provider for their people. They give them, the sacraments. They give them nourishment. They provide the bread of life for Christians. They're leading, they're shepherding, they're leading their flocks, and they're showing their children how to be, what it looks like to be a good father, what it looks like to treat their mother well, whether it be an actual mother or the mother, which is the church, like how to take care of her, and also how to be a good son and daughter. And it really just comes back to this first role, and I think it ties into very closely this first role of being a son or being a daughter. It's recognizing the justice of recognizing that this life that we have is a gift given to us by our father, whether it be our biological father or our earthly father. We should be grateful for this and thankful for this, and recognizing the dependence we have on our father for this. So whether it be recognizing as a Christian, God the Father has given life to us, has given us everything that we have, or even if you're not religious, you can still, in some way, I don't think it's a complete way, but you can still recognize this priest role, teaching your kids how to be thankful, how to be grateful, how to recognize the gifts they've been given, how to sacrifice for other people and provide for other people and protect for other people, how to be generous and give to other people, to give what you have out of the abundance of what you have to help and serve other people. And this is what it means to be a priest. Obviously, there's a lot more to that. But I think being the priest, honestly, I feel like it ties everything together about what it means to be a man, whether it's a brother, a father, a husband. It kind of ties all those things together.
Well said. I have nothing to add to that. And I don't know if I should, considering I think this is maybe the longest episode that we've recorded back to back. So this will certainly be cut into two or three parts, not even to speak of the episode that we'll be releasing after this, which is kind of to talk about some roles that are outside of the home. But Brian, did you have any last minute thoughts on some of these kind of internal or homely roles that we've been discussing the past hour and a half?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of what, I'm trying to play the devil's advocate, think about what people might have to say about this. And I kind of wonder, you know, is someone listening to this and wondering, well, aren't we just making double standards for men and women? You know, men, they're the leaders. Women don't have to be the leaders. What do you think about this whole idea of having different standards for men and for women about what their roles are and how to fulfill and grow in those roles?
Yeah, so I think this question, without a doubt, is kind of rooted in the substitutionary theory that we've mentioned a couple of times, where men and women are seen as substitutes. I know we've kind of dismissed that in the past, but just to get into that again, it's important to realize the harm that comes from that. Both because, as we've mentioned throughout the past few episodes, there are very real psychological and physiological impulses and trends between men and women that make them different. You know, if you believe that men and women are substitutes, and whether it's just in, you know, the office or whether it's kind of in general, you both cheapen men, but you also cheapen women, which I think is actually the opposite goal of what a lot of these people that are pushing this theory want. And by cheapening them, you end up with really just lower class masculinity and lower class femininity. And by that I mean is that it becomes a lot harder to discern what is good. It becomes a lot harder to discern what we should be doing. And you end up with a lot of the problems that I think a lot of people are talking about, like divorce, fractured families, single motherhood, and things like that, because men don't really know how to be men and women don't really know how to be women, because these are things that need to mature. I mean, we mentioned in the beginning that the importance of being a son or a daughter is to learn obedience, to learn affection, and to really begin to cultivate like virtues such as that. Gratitude's another one. Because if you don't learn it then, it's going to be a lot harder to learn it later on. And if you go through life kind of with the mindset that you don't have anything you need to work on, which I think the substitutionary theory really holds, then you're not really going to get anywhere. You're not going to become a good or virtuous person, whether you're a man or a woman, and you're not going to be able to provide or even be the best person you can be for your family or your community. So whether they're double standards or not, I'm going to just completely dismiss that question, because at the end of the day, I'm going to say men and women should have, you know, two different goals, two different sets of people to look up to, two different sets of, you know, not virtues per se, but the way that the virtues are implemented is very important to realize, because at the end of the day, they are complementary. Men and women complement one another. Women compensate for men's weaknesses, men compensate for women's weaknesses, and if they really integrate well while trying to seek that complementariness and becoming one while still maintaining those two separate natures that is so often described, you know, in like marriage, and when you're talking about marriage, that is, I think, the best way to go about it. That is the thing that leads to much more happy and productive marriages. It leads to happier men, happier women, and it also just leads us to kind of focus on the things that we're good at And in many ways, that's a very economic thing. It's kind of like the specialization. But I think that that is something that's very important. And if you look throughout history at a lot of very great examples of good men and good women, you'll find that they were not pursuing something that was other than their nature. I don't know of any men that were pursuing womanly things, and I don't know of any women that were pursuing manly things. I mean, you can get back to Joan of Arc, but, you know, again, the exception does not disprove the rule. So maybe there's been a couple, but they're not exactly the most commendable. And if they are commendable, it typically is because of supernatural reasons, again, with St. Joan of Arc. So that's my response to that. It's to kind of dismiss the question and introduce another one. So I hope that that answers it for you, Brian, and really for our listeners.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's a great point, because these aren't just restrictions just for the sake of restricting. It's not intended to be oppressive. It certainly can be, and if that's the case, then, you know, we need to look at that. But these roles are not in and of itself oppressive. They are restrictions, and restrictions are not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, you need to restrict things like, for example, if I'm growing a plant, I put it in a pot and restrict it in that pot so it can grow. So if we think about these, the whole point is we should recognize and adopt these and grow into these, because it's part of who we are, and it's going to help us to grow and to become better men, better women, more virtuous, and to really help our society to be more cohesive and work together.
It's funny. I like your plants in a pot example. If I'm a daisy and I grow up, or and I want to be a rose when I grow up, and I try to be a rose, well, I'm not going to really be a rose, no matter what I really think, and it's just going to end up being the worse for me. And if I truly want to grow up and be the best I can be, well, I'll grow up and be the best daisy. And that's a very feminine example of flowers, but I think it still works, you know, because
a strong oak tree.
Right. Oh, that, I guess I'm a woman because I'm thinking of flowers, but yeah, no, that's a great example. If I'm an oak tree and I want to be a rose, well, that's going to be terrible. My life's going to be miserable, you know? So don't try to fool yourself. The best thing we can do is to kind of pursue these things humbly, because humility really is probably the biggest catalyst for virtue and for being and living a good life in general, being a good man, all of that stuff, being a good woman as well. Because if you go about thinking that you, you have all of the answers, you know exactly what you want, and you're really dismissive of reality, well, reality is still going to come down and smack you in the face a lot. And it may not smack you in the face, like you may never learn that you're an oak tree and you can't be a rose, but you're going to be miserable your entire life if you continue trying to deceive yourself and thinking that you can be a rose, let alone a good rose. So this entire series is really just about trying to, you know, talk about what's different about men and women and help kind of spur you to want that and to at the very least realize that there are these differences, because it is so unfortunately dismissed in modern times.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I got. I think that's a good way to end it.
Yeah, that's all I got too. Well, we really want to thank you for listening to this incredibly long conversation, which, as I mentioned, will probably be 2 or 3 episodes without a doubt. Please take some time to leave us a rating and review. It's really, really helpful. We've been growing a lot because of them. So to all the gentlemen out there that have left us rating and reviews, thank you. You can also find all of our show notes, whether down below on whatever podcast platform you're listening on or on our website, since we've been adding those. Links are in the show notes below. You can find us on Twitter at TheVMPod, or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/vitalmasculinitypage. So we will definitely also provide links for that below, but we want you to join the conversation because we appreciate connecting with you gentlemen, and we really do want to make sure we're all here for each other, particularly in these unprecedented pandemic coronavirus fun times. But thank you again for listening, gentlemen. Do all the things that I just mentioned, because that'll very much help us out. It'll help you out too, we hope. And just always remember, virtue makes the man. Have a good one.